Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on Wednesday morning. I normally open our show with a quote or a poem or something, and I saw this poem written by Michael Ward. And I was like, wow, this is great. It's timely. It's perfect. And then I realized, well, Michael lives in New Hampshire, and maybe I can reach out to Michael, and Michael can actually read the poem he wrote. And Michael has agreed to do this. So we're doing something totally unique for The Attitude. We're going to actually have our poet read his own poem. But before you do, Michael, I asked you for your bio, and I want people to hear the bio. So in some ways, it sets the background, the foundation for the poem you're about to read. Michael Cameron Ward is a retired computer geek engaged in his second career as a writer, performer, and social commentator. In 1957, his family relocated from Brooklyn, New York to Lee, New Hampshire to escape gang violence. On the same day as Little Rock, Arkansas, he and his three siblings integrated the Oyster River School District. The National Guard was not mobilized, but as the only Black family in the district, it was a challenge. The family's code meant that their experiences were never shared, even among their closest friends. Before his father, Harold Ward, passed away at age 94 in 2015, he asked that Michael write their story. Michael, we've been quiet long enough. I want you to tell our story. Tell it all and don't hold anything back. From that request, the Sketches of Lee collection was born. Michael resides in his family home in Lee, New Hampshire, where he reads, writes, bicycles, renovates the house, and raises pigs. With that, Mr. Ward, thank you so much for doing this. And I'm going to ask you to read your poem, and then I'm going to say au revoir, but I have a funny feeling we'll get you back just to have a conversation about your experiences in Lee, New Hampshire. But please read your poem to my audience.
I write after stressful situations. Instead of holding it all in, I let it out.
Okay.
America, preconditioned. We're preconditioned not to care until the next inhumane video assaults us from on air. Violence, exhaustion dissipates, silently, coldly, surely, a soul without debates. Repetitive event reaction carves sensitivity to a fraction. No matter how obscene, to visualize once for eternity will suffice. Do not revisit what can't be unseen twice. Learn to keep your distance from visuals that entrance, torrents of fears, spawn a hurricane of tears that escapes us and splatters. Our perception of humanity shatters. As bystanders, we reflect with helplessness and rage at official and lethal disrespect. There was no complaint about an unarmed stranger, but police viewed the individual an existential danger. Beaten, tased, and clubbed while securely held in restraint. A bereaved mother's pride with dignity admonishes, "My boy is gone. Don't roar in the night outside. To stage a police counterattack, no amount of mayhem and ruin will bring my baby back." Media viewers contemplate immobilized pillars of salt while metal storms of bullets and a thunder rain of blows seal a Black man's fate in a barrage they cannot halt. The U.S. Congress is proud that from the law enforcement crowd, cash scooped up like birdseed, while neither accept their misdeed. If it bleeds, it leads. Death is the corpulent cash cow upon which the media feeds. We are preconditioned not to care until the next inhumane video assaults us from the air.
Thank you, Michael. We will be talking again soon. And I appreciate your reading this for our audience. The timing is just remarkable. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Ward.
Thank you. And I wish I didn't have to have the timing.
I know, me too. Anyway, ciao. Thank you so much.
Sure enough. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Joining us for our first guest is a professor. And it was an article that I read in a number of papers around the country. And I was not aware of this because I'm kind of a Luddite. But I decided I had to reach out to the professor that was the focus of the article, both at the New York Times and in so many other places. It was entitled "Alarmed by AI Chatbots, Universities Start Revamping How They Teach." With the rise of the popular new chatbot, ChatGPT, Colleges are restructuring some courses and taking preventative measures. And I'm going to introduce our professor by reading the opening lines, Professor Ullman, in the New York Times article. While grading essays for his World Religions course last month, Anthony Ullman, a professor of philosophy at Northern Michigan University, read what he said was easily the best paper in the class. It explored the morality of burqa bans with clean paragraphs, fitting examples, and rigorous arguments. A red flag instantly went up as Mr. Ullman confronted his student over whether he'd actually written the essay himself. The student confessed to using ChatGPT, a chatbot that delivers information, explains concepts, and generates ideas in simple sentences, and in this case, had written the paper. Alarmed by his discovery, Mr. Ullman decided to transform essay writing for his courses this semester. He plans to require students to write first drafts in the classroom using browsers that monitor and restrict computer activity. And then it continues to go on. I want to welcome Anthony to the program. He joined the faculty at Northern in the fall of 2010. He has also held positions at Ohio State, St. Olaf, and Fordham University, and regularly teaches courses on aesthetics, religion, and existentialism. He coordinates the religious studies minor. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And this article blew my mind.
Thanks for having me, Arnie. I'm happy to be here.
So I'm going to confess something to you, all right? I was a religion major undergrad. In fact, I was on my way to divinity school. I went to St. Olaf. I told you that. Yeah. But can I tell you what I did? I'm 69, so this is a long time ago. I cheated.
Okay. What did you cheat on?
Christian ethics. I cheated on a paper in Christian ethics.
And what'd
I
you do?
Caught. I copied a couple of paragraphs. Okay. And it was obvious. And I got caught. And I was an honor student. And the professor called me in and flunked me, and I lost my honors. And then he did something which was remarkable, because I will tell you that I was suicidal. I was suicidal. I wanted to kill myself. And he said to me, you know what's so depressing to me, Arnie Arneson, is that you don't trust yourself. He said, you don't trust your own voice. You don't trust how you process. Trust yourself. All right. And that was profound and so incredibly forgiving. And what was interesting was, is that in 1997, I was a fellow at Harvard and I got approached by the Boston Globe and they asked me to write a column. And my initial reaction was, no, I can't. I talk. I don't write. Okay. Because I'm still, all those years later, I still have this incredible fear. And the Globe editor took me out to lunch. And she said, well, actually, Arnie, you do write. Just write like you talk. All right. So as I'm reading about this, I want to talk to all those students. I want to shake them up. I want to ask them, what are you going to school for? If this ChatGPT does your work, then you're not doing the work and you're not doing the learning. And so this story is so freaking depressing. And yet it makes me go back to my early years. Why are you there? What are you intending to learn? And what skills have you accomplished if ChatGPT does all that effort? So welcome to the program and talk to me about being who you are, being a professor, seeing this, recognizing that it's spreading like wildfire. And I'm trying to figure out, how do we determine for ourselves what's real and what's Memorex? I feel like we're living in a fact-free environment, and now we're living in original free environment. And that is not good for a future and not good for society.
Yeah, I think that a couple of factors are contributing to my students' inclination to use this. I think they are jaded about the purpose of an education, that they see it merely as a means to an end of getting a job. And many of them are not there just for the sake of learning, like you might have been, or maybe I might have been, but they're there just to get that degree. And when that's your attitude, everything becomes hoop jumping. In addition to that, a lot of my students they're tired, they're stressed, they have multiple jobs that they're trying to do just to pay for college. And with all of those pressures on them, I guess it starts to become a little bit understandable to me.
So now what do you do? Okay, so now we're getting cleverer and cleverer. Social media has changed our lives, okay? You're going to love this. I tell my audience this story all the time because we confuse social media with life. We confuse our Facebook friends with friends. They ain't my friends. I got 4,000 people on Facebook. I may know 100 of them. Okay. I'm even offended at the words that we're told to use. And yet it's how we are now. We're living in this world. You know, this is our landscape. So given that this is our landscape and you are an educator and this feels like it undermines every reason why you teach. Okay, because you teach for them to learn. And of course, as you point out, yes, there's a lot of stresses. Can I pay for school? I'm working all these part-time jobs. I need to get this job. I need to get this GPA because I need to get, you know, this grade point average for me to get there. I mean, they're trying to figure out everything because is the goal knowledge or is the goal some box you're going to check off? But in the end, they're there to learn. So they may be clever by using this, but the cleverness undermines the whole point of education. So how do we confront students to realize that if your goal is to learn, then don't use this. If your goal is to accomplish some other task, well, then you can go to this course because this course says that you know how to Google really well, or you know how to put the right input into ChatGPT, and therefore that will accomplish your task. Maybe we need a bifurcated education system, one that's purely about knowledge and the other one that's about effectively cheating. You know, I don't even know. I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'm looking at this world and I'm thinking, really, how do we define success? And I'm not even sure we even know what that means anymore.
I guess one thing I would say is that for me, at least, the phenomenon of ChatGPT is morally more complicated than you're making it out to be.
Okay.
Partly because I think that there are good aspects of it too. For example, I'll tell you about my use of it in my own career. I'm in a small department. I don't have a lot of colleagues. And often I want feedback on something that I'm writing and I just can't get it because people are busy. So what I do is I'll take a draft that I've written and I submit it to the chat and I say, hey, what are some ways that I could improve my writing? Or what are some possible objections that someone who disagrees with me might have? And sometimes it has silly things to say, but to be honest, sometimes it has really good things to say. And so then I do the hard work of trying to incorporate that feedback into my own essay writing. And in this regard, the chat can be used like another person. And you can see the power of that in education. Class sizes have ballooned. Students cannot get the individualized attention that maybe you got at St. Olaf College. And so what the chat can provide, if the students use it well, is something like highly specific, individualized feedback to exactly what their problems are. The problem is that there's this huge gulf between responsibly using this amazing tool and just mindlessly copying whatever it tells you.
I hear you, and I think that's a good thing. And yet what you just described started with you. It started with the original human being who did the work, who wrote the thesis or whatever it was, who wants to improve the product, but you are the product. What I was so frightened by this article and what ChatGPT is that they're not the product. It is, you know, they put the right code words in that they then were able to use ChatGPT to produce something and then they put their name on it. So it was dishonest in the sense that this was not their product. But now that we know that you can use it effectively, which I hear, and now I know that people can use it to cheat, what do you do? What are faculty talking about around the country in order to accomplish this? And the reason I'm going to ask this question is I'm an example of what you do. And let me tell you why. Remember I told you I cheated? Okay. I was suicidal. I didn't know what to do. So what did I do? I used my voice. Why did I want to become a minister? Because I would do these oral sermons. Why did I go onto radio? Because I would speak. Why did I do talk TV? Because I could talk. Therefore, there was nobody in my head. I wasn't reading something else. I wasn't like lifting something and scripting it. It was all Arnie. And in a way, that oral ability to process, like you're watching me do now, means that it's me. Okay, it's me. So are you now sort of requiring more of that interaction between students where you're not sending it home with them? You're not asking them to write a paper. What you're asking them to do is to sort of hear them process what they know and the knowledge they've gleaned.
There's a lot of interesting questions and problems that you're raising here. I can tell you a few things that people are doing to try to make sure that the starting point is the student's own voice and why some of those things aren't quite working well, and why we're kind of at our wit's end as to how to really require students to do what you're describing. So one thing that people are doing is moving to oral exams. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have an oral exam in the front of class and the student doesn't have access to their computer or their phone, it has to be their voice. But that doesn't work in big classes, right? There's just too many students. Right. People are going old school, paper and pencil. And I think that works for your generation or my generation. I was trained to write cursive. I was trained to write fast and neatly at a very young age. This generation just wasn't. And so very few of my students can write legibly, let alone quickly, for any length of time. And it's not practical.
Right.
You can try doing one other thing, which is ask them about recent texts. The chat is only trained on texts up to 2021. It doesn't know anything about recent stuff. But try doing that in a class on Aquinas or Augustine or Plato and Aristotle. What do you do? I don't know. There's other strategies that I can tell you about, but I'm always back at this point of I don't know.
This is killing me because, you know, being a former politician, I describe myself as a politician in recovery, okay? And I'm looking at George Santos, and I'm looking at Donald Trump, and I'm looking at all the fiction that people bring to the table when they try to describe themselves. I mean, in a lot of ways, I almost feel like George Santos went into ChatGPT. And what he said was, what do I have to be in order to get elected? And they said, you have to be Jewish. You have to be gayish. You have to be the Holocaust. I mean, think about this. He is a composite human being. I remember the stories of Betty Crocker. She had somebody else's eyes and somebody's nose and somebody's hair. And I mean, in a lot of ways, George Santos is ChatGPT. It's the composite that proved the success. Was it real? No. But did he claim to be all those things? Absolutely. Did it win? Christ, yes. But look what he won. He won so that he is now basically, he's like nuclear waste. Nobody wants to be near him. You know, people are tolerating him. So the success actually also bred the failure. As I'm hearing you, I guess it's almost like we have to go back to the very beginning of education and talk to students about what it is that we are doing. What does learning mean? And I think we've never really had that conversation about what does learning mean. This is just so depressing to me because I am just trying to figure out what you do, but it's not what you do, it's what does society do when it wants to value what is real, or maybe I'm old school because maybe that isn't valued anymore. Maybe I'm living in another world and another time, but I can't believe that.
I just don't know how much that argument is going to resonate with a lot of my students. Most of my students are here to learn in the way that you might have been inspired to learn. I think that the kind of people that were going to college in your generation were a very different kind of people than are going to college now. So many kids just feel pushed into college as part of the American capitalistic machine. You know, because they think that this is the only way to succeed in society. And here you're trying to sell them on this other value. And I think a lot of my students would be like, I'm not sure that they care about that. Some of them do. I have great kids too, you know, but I'm not saying that all my students are just in it for the money or they're just interested in jumping through the hoops to get the degree. But I think that the number of students who are really there because they care about learning for its own sake, I mean, I try to inspire them to that, but yeah, I'm not sure.
You know, back in 1971, which is when I started at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, yeah, sure, you betcha, I did something really sort of quirky. I joined Air Force ROTC. And why am I telling you this? Because it was like around the Vietnam War, the end of the Vietnam War, and I had seen a lot of my friends being drafted. And I suddenly realized that either all of us go or none of us go. And that I saw this as a collective action and not an action that just young men get drafted and make these decisions. And I think what's also sort of undermining our understanding of right and wrong, or why am I learning, or what is the goal, is that we have no community Velcro. We have nothing that holds us together that might both introduce us to each other and also establish something in the way of standards that we respect. And as you tell me that your students may not care because, you know, they've been pushed into college, I mean, I don't want to push anyone into anything, but I want them to feel accomplished and I want them to feel a part. And is that part of the problem is that you can embrace ChatGPT because what you're doing is not really a reflection of you. Now, you've been told to check off this box. All right, I'll check off this box. What do I need to do? Now, that means that you don't own it. And I guess maybe the question then becomes, how do we give kids a sense of what it is that they are and they accomplish as a sense of ownership? Because if you want to own it, you don't want to cheat.
I think that's the question that every teacher asks themselves. How do I inspire my students to think that their voices matter? How do I inspire my students to think like, I mean, I think it's kind of an attitude with which I approach class. Am I there just to spit ideas at them? Am I there just to, you know, regurgitate my daily lecture at them? And I think the mentality that I try to bring to class is that we're having a discussion about these topics where I honestly care where the students are, where each one of them is about this. And sometimes I succeed in that and sometimes I fail at that. I have this idea, though, that like maybe where ChatGPT is going to push us at the end of the day is a good thing. It's going to push us past all of the hoop jumping because it's so easy to cheat. Like all of the tests, all of the exams, all of this bureaucratic machinery that we've created will just become meaningless. So we can return to just like the way that Socrates and Plato did it originally, which is just, let's have a conversation about this. Let's forget about all the grades because it's meaningless because you can just cheat your way forward. I guess I have this sort of utopian hope that like, I just say like, okay, whatever, do the tests with the ChatGPT. Let's come to class. We'll give you all A's. Can we just talk about this today? I have a vision where that may happen someday.
In some ways, I think maybe you're right. I mean, we've been doing a lot. I teach a class with a professor from Boston University. I don't teach it. He teaches it and I'm his student. But we do it on the radio. It's called Race Class. Okay. And so this summer, we spent a lot of time talking about affirmative action. I mean, a lot of time. And I almost feel bad for legacy students. Because legacy students really know that they don't probably belong there. Daddy gave the building, you're the fourth generation, you're the first whatever. And yet when you look at the grades of a legacy student and you look at the accomplishments of legacy students and then you look at everybody else, you realize that really what got them in was a check and a name, okay? That can't feel good. That in the end, I mean, yeah, you got the degree and yeah, you got the name. But I feel like in some ways it's kind of like the legacy is a little bit like ChatGPT, you know? Is it real or is it Memorex? And I guess what I'm trying to figure out is you see a future where these things won't have meaning. And I think maybe you say that your students sometimes don't necessarily feel like they're heard or they're seen or they're understood or whatever. And I'm going to go back to politics because I look at the urgency of the moment. And the urgency of the moment with the climate crisis, and the urgency of the moment with student debt, and the urgency of the moment with the pandemic, and the urgency of the moment with the instability of the world is not about me. It's about them. It's about them. And that may be one of the ways to address things like ChatGPT or just check the box or get the goal is that we need to have a politics that sees them and recognizes their struggles. Because look what you said to me. My students are doing so many things. There's so many things on their plate. They're working so many jobs. They're doing all this. And that is because we have failed them. And I think that if we stop failing them, then maybe they will decide that who they are and what they know and what they learn is important. But right now, what they are being told is that they're not important.
So I think that there's both a collective societal problem that we need to address here that you're talking about, like that political solution. How do we get at a societal level the message across that their individual voices matter? But I do think that there's also individual action that teachers, professors, college professors, high school teachers can take. And it's at that level that I almost want to push back against some of the stuff about affirmative action that you said. Okay. I just don't care why my students are there. You know, if it took a scholarship or daddy writing a check for a building or anything else, it doesn't matter. You're here now. And my job is to find a way to engage you because you're here now and transform your life. And I think that like maybe we can have some hope in good teachers out there that can play that role, even if the capitalistic machine is pushing people through, even if like some misguided versions of legacy hires or legacy enrollment is pushing students in there that don't belong, the individual teacher can still make a difference if they can just say to each student, hey, I care for you. This is actually one of the great things about Northern Michigan University. We're kind of a right to try school. And what that means is we have all kinds of students in there who couldn't get into other colleges, all kinds of students whose parents did not believe in them, who've never had anybody believe in them. But that means that we can do some real transformative work. And maybe, just maybe, like on this individual teacher level, we can make a difference that it's really hard to make on the political societal level that you're worried about.
So I guess what our conversation really ends with is that there is not one solution. There is a quilt of solutions, and every one of those solutions is going to touch people in different ways. It's going to get a different student in a different way. I'm looking at, and the reason I do politics so much so is I'm looking at what you're saying, and then I'm looking at Ron DeSantis in Florida, who's undermining everything that you're talking about, who's basically like killing curiosity, you know, frightening people about teaching, not allowing them to sort of engage with their students. And that to me is incredibly terrifying, because just as you are trying to figure out how you can relate to your students and recognize, yeah, ChatGPT is going to be there, but that's really not what the enemy is, you know? And then the question then becomes, so how do I do this? And I look at you and I applaud you. And then I look at a governor in Florida who wants to be president of the United States, and I am terrified. So, I mean, in a lot of ways, that's another reason to sort of have your voice elevated, because people want you as a teacher. I don't care what you are, conservative, Republican, liberal, Democrat, whatever. That's the kind of teacher you want, because that's a teacher that says your student and your child matters. And in the end, that's what parents want. They want their kid to matter. And I think that's where what you are saying is important. And it's going to be very interesting to see how colleges approach ChatGPT, what we do. You know, now there's, I guess there's a group that you can sort of run something through and you can sort of identify this is a ChatGPT response and not whatever. But again, it's sort of like, okay, so what does that get you? You know, now that we know that you cheated, even though we had a sense that you cheated, what have I accomplished? And I'm not quite sure what. And I'm going to sort of end with, again, another story that I've told my audience over and over again, because I think these are ways for people to process what it is they want, both from education, from our teacher, and from themselves. And it was maybe 20 or 30 years ago, maybe even more than that, I'm at Dartmouth, and Dartmouth at the time in Hanover did not have the synagogue, so they were using the Rollins Chapel as a synagogue. And it was a bar mitzvah, and we were invited to the bar mitzvah. And this little 13-year-old boy was asked by his rabbi, so what did you learn this year, my son? And the little boy looked at his parents and looked at the rabbi and then looked at the congregation. And these are the most profound words I will have ever heard. He said, I learned that doing right is hard. I learned that doing right is hard. And I suddenly realized, I don't think I'd ever taught my children that. I don't think I'd ever said that. And here I had to learn it from a little 13-year-old boy. But I've held on to that my whole life, because I think that is part of the challenge for your students. It's part of the challenge as a professor. It's part of the challenge of someone who wants to do policy. It's not going to be easy to do right. That doesn't mean that you don't try. So here's the deal. I'm going to do this. A year from now, I'm going to call you and I'm going to ask you, after having read this article at the New York Times, and it was repeated everywhere along the country, the title of the article was Alarmed by AI Chatbots, Universities Start Revamping How They Teach. With the rise of the popular new chatbot, ChatGPT, colleges are restructuring some courses and taking preventative measures. Professor Oman has been joining us to talk about his experience at Northern Michigan. Thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it. Good luck. You're a good teacher. A year from now, I want to know whether you figured out even another skill set with your students and how to sort of both maneuver with ChatGPT as part of your life and also recognizing that your goal is to educate. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me, Arnie.
It was a pleasure. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arnison, our producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
James Whitey Bulger, an organized crime kingpin in Boston for decades, extorted, tortured, and murdered people.
I'm criminal defense attorney Luke Ryan, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
After an FBI agent gave Bulger a heads up about his imminent indictment in 1994, Bulger skipped town and lived on the lam until his arrest in 2011, after which he was tried, convicted, and sentenced to two life terms plus 5 years. Bulger's FBI handler helped him because Bulger also was an FBI informant. And in prison, informants can be in deep trouble. Indeed, when Bulger was transferred to the Hazleton, West Virginia Penitentiary in 2018, where known enemies of his were doing time, inmates placed bets on how long he would survive, which wasn't long. Within hours of his arrival, he was bludgeoned to death. The recent Inspector General's report says that Bulger, who is a frail 89-year-old in a wheelchair, should never have been transferred to that prison and never placed in general population there. Never, not even close. Prison authorities knew that Bulger, an obviously in many ways atypical inmate, would receive enormous publicity if something happened to him. Which raises the bigger question. How much attention do we pay to the safety and health of the not famous more than 2 million people locked up in American prisons and jails today?
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because, as the criminal legal system proves every day, freedom can't protect itself.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and our producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, we continue to record on Wednesday morning. I go to my favorite site, theconversation.com. I check it out all the time because I get to hang out with some really brilliant professors and PhD students from not only the United States, but from around the world. And I knew that I would find someone who would be responding to the issues at hand. The title of the piece at The Conversation was Black Police Officers Aren't Colorblind. They're infected by the same anti-Black bias as American society and police in general. And before I introduce my guest, I want to do something. I'm going to share with my guest the two quotes that I started yesterday's show with, okay? Here they are. The race of a cop is cop. That's by Bakari Sellers. And then by Jason Sole, all your skin folk ain't kin folk. That was how I began yesterday. But let me explain how we reached Rashad Shabazz. And this is how the conversation, because they reached out to you, so I'm going to let my audience know that. Once again, this is what they said at the conversation. Once again, Americans are left reeling from the horror of video footage showing police brutalizing an unarmed Black man who later died. Some details in the latest case of extreme police violence were gut-wrenchingly familiar. A police traffic stop by a Black male motorist turned violent. But for many of us, other details were unfamiliar. The five police officers accused of using everything from pepper spray to a taser to a police baton and intermittent kicks and punches against the motorists were also Black. After pulling over 29-year-old Tyra Nichols for what they said was reckless driving, Black officers in the Memphis Police Department, now disbanded Scorpion Unit, beat Nichols ultimately to death. The conversation asked Rashad Shabazz, a geographer and scholar of African American studies at Arizona State University, to explore the societal conditions in which Black police officers could brutalize another Black man. Rashad, thank you so much for rearranging your schedule and joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm appalled. I'm not surprised. Like you, I couldn't watch the video. I turned away. I couldn't stomach it. Two things went through my head. And then talk to me about what went through yours. My daughter just had a baby 2 years ago in Shanghai. Her husband is Chinese. And so my granddaughters have Chinese. And I keep remembering the song from South Pacific. You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught year after year. Mm-hmm. And that song it's in my head all the time. But of course I'm thinking about my little granddaughter, and now I'm thinking about what happened to this young Black man. All right. And then the other thing that I kept thinking about is I was avoiding my eyes and not watching the video and hearing the stories and just wanting to sort of fall down into a heap of tears is that, remember the Black doll, white doll study, the Clark study? And to this day, I will never forget it. And that's where they put a number of dolls out, Black dolls and white dolls. And then they asked the children to pick up the good doll and the bad doll. And it turned out that even the young Black children picked up the white doll as the good doll and ignored the Black doll and assumed that the Black doll was the bad doll. And I don't know if you know this, Rashad, but The Conversation interviewed someone in 2021 who sort of replicated that just recently, okay? Only she brought little Black kids and Hispanic kids and white kids and Asian kids, and she put all kinds of dolls out. But the same thing sort of happened again in 2021. So as I'm watching them describe what happened with this young man, I kept screaming, the Black doll, the Black doll. And yet we haven't been able to change how we see life and how they see life. So talk to me about your reaction, how you process, and give me some tools to understand how we can begin to address it. I may not be able to do it in Congress. I may not be able to do it at the state level, but maybe there are things I can do as an individual so that we can begin to sort of recognize our humanity and our inhumanity.
All right, thank you for having me. So I'll address those questions. So when I first heard about the incident a couple of weeks ago, you know, again, I was just frustrated, you know, enraged, and, you know, yet again, another unarmed Black man, unarmed Black person dies at the hands of state police officers. And when the details began to emerge, both, you know, fear and anxiety and anger began to boil over. And I really began to think about what was going to happen when the video was released, because this is the thing, you know, these horrible episodes that are caught on camera, either by dash cams or police recordings or through bystanders, they oftentimes end up on social media feeds. They end up on newspaper websites, and, you know, to sort of relive those horrible moments are extremely difficult and excruciating. And in many respects, what it does is it sort of, you know, it can reproduce the same lack of value for Black life that happens in the moment that those forms of violence are being articulated on Black people. So I can't watch them. I only watched a little bit of this one because it was important for the story, but I could only get through about 20 or 30 seconds. And you know, there are multiple issues at play here. You know, the one issue is that this is the way in which policing in the United States has really always operated. This is not different from the way in which policing was constituted, the way in which it has been historically organized, and the way in which it has played out for much of the last century. So there's no divergence here. Black people have been cast as and seen as domestic enemies and have been treated as such. Just one example, the war on drugs. All bits of scholarly research demonstrate that when it comes to drug use, Blacks, whites, and other people of color use drugs at relatively similar rates. Actually, you know, white Americans use them at a slightly larger clip. But the war on drugs was fought in Black and brown territory. It was fought in ghettos and barrios, and Black and brown people paid the highest casualty for that war. And it really sends a message, and it illustrates that there is something about this group, about these people that don't matter, that they are signifiers of criminality, and their criminality is somehow different. And so what I'm trying to do in the piece is to demonstrate that, one, this is not at all antithetical to policing, that this has always been part of policing. And that, two, even with Black officers being involved in the beating, it still reproduces the same set of culturally inscribed ideas, right? And so there are two types of culturally inscribed ideas here. One is that institutionally, policing has been built around focusing its attention on Black people and treating them as domestic enemies. The second culture is the sort of culture around—
Let me just stop you, because I want to say that sentence again, that they have been basically sort of trained to see Black people as domestic enemies. That statement alone is just so terrifying. And yet, I think to a large extent, it sort of explains not only whether it was a black cop or a white cop, but if that is the culture of the cop and the culture of the police, then it doesn't matter the color of the cop. What it matters is what is the focus, and the focus will be these black domestic terrorists.
Policing has been built around seeing black people as domestic threats and has harnessed its power institutionally to deal with this perceived threat. The other cultural apparatus that's operating here is a broader one. And if I can just do, you know, just to do a little bit of explanation, what I mean when I say culture.
Culture.
Is not a, it's not a synonym for race and ethnicity, that, you know, people in the country tend to say we are different cultures as a way to try to signify something about our race and ethnicity. That's not what culture is about, right? Culture really is a set of signs that help to make life in a geographic location and period of time intelligible. Without signs, we would have to constantly explain things to ourselves and to other people all the time, over and over and over again. And what signs do, whether that sign is a person, whether that sign is a piece of property, whether that sign is some kind of inanimate object, what these signs do is they allow us to communicate information and to have a kind of shared map of meaning about what things are and how they work. Without signs, life would be unintelligible. Everything would terrify us all the time. We'd look at a shoe and we wouldn't know what it is. We'd see a stop sign and we'd be confused. You know, that we would be terrified. And so what these signs do is they communicate vast amounts of information quickly. They allow us to have a shared understanding of the world around us, and that in these
and what I'm hearing from you is that they organize behavior.
They inform our sense of ourselves and the world around us. That's what they do. They inform our sense of ourselves and the world around us. And these signs are not just inanimate objects like stop signs or shoes or computers or buildings. They're also people. Race is historically produced, meaning it changes over time. It is socially produced, meaning that humans created it. It is not a biological phenomenon. But race is also a sign, a signifier. And when we look at racial bodies, all of the maps of meaning in that place, in that time, that construct and figure that racial body become the ways in which we understand both ourselves and the racial other. And in this country, and in much of the Western world, Blackness is a signifier of danger, of threat, and of what Du Bois called a problem. And policing has oriented its apparatus toward dealing with this perceived domestic threat. And because Blackness is seen in this way, because this is part of the kind of cultural lingua franca of the Western world, Black people are not immune from it. Black people don't stand outside the culture. Black people are part of the culture. We participate in it. We understand the signs. We understand the signifiers. And even if that sign or signifier looks like us or looks like our brother or sister, we can still be propelled to respond to that sign in the same way that the broader culture does, to see them as less than, to see their life as valuable, to see them as perpetual threats, to see them as signifiers of danger. And as a result, you get an institution like policing that has oriented itself toward dealing with this perceived domestic threat, alongside of this broader cultural apparatus that sees Blackness as a signifier of danger. And it's a powerful cocktail that can induce even Black officers to beat a Black man who looks just like them to death.
And they would not have beaten a white man. You see, that's the thing, because again, you're telling me that they perceive the black as the domestic terrorist, okay? They've been given a license. They're in this culture. They've been given authority. And they've also seen, to some extent, they've been given a pass. So that if you beat up a black guy versus beating up a white guy, their likelihood is that you will survive that beating. So in a lot of ways, all the check marks sort of reinforce their behavior. Even though their behavior is so wrong, and yet look what we've done to the police. We've militarized the police. Mm-hmm. You know, we've made them more and more. This is not about officers of the peace. This is about someone who basically comes in with a bat and a baton and a scorpion and a this. And the assumption is they're not there to sort of stabilize something. They're to look for rot. They're not looking for anything in order to fix it. They're looking at something in order to retaliate against it. I mean, I want a cop to come in and fix things. These guys don't want to fix. They want to arrest. That's not a fix. That's the headset, I think, that we see in cops all over the country.
Absolutely. And when it comes to questions of whiteness, the cultural signifier of whiteness is just different. Universality, normativeness. On some level, a certain kind of, you know, non-threateningness. You know, if you just sort of look at the historical record, I mean, that is, you know, absolutely incorrect. You know, going back, you know, several centuries, right? You know, the relationship between whiteness and violence is deeply grooved into the nation's history, whether we're talking about settler colonialism and the sort of genocidal logic that it enabled vis-a-vis indigenous people, the enslavement of people of African descent, you know, the profound structural mistreatment of Asian Americans, you know, I could go on. And so this sort of sign that whiteness means non-threatening, that there's some kind of universality or normativity, one of the things that can do institutionally, is that it can move the police's focus vis-a-vis questions around drug use, going back to my earlier point, away from them, simply to move it away from them. It can, for example, allow for white men not to be seen as threats. And the entire exchange between them and the police is very different, right? So there's lots of ways that this cultural sign plays out. It plays out in everyday humans. We all use those signifiers. We all understand what those signs mean. We all participate in it. And also institutions, which are made up of people, are also reading those signs and understanding how they operate and responding to people based on these cultural signifiers, right? And this is the thing that's really important here. There is no one in this country, and really in much of the Western world, that does not understand the cultural signifiers of Blackness. No one is outside the culture. No one is not privy to the discourses, the messages, the images, the historical narratives, the representations of Blackness as this other kind of subject, perpetually athletic, sexually deviant, threatening, violent, unintelligent. You know, we are all privy to that, right? And the belief that somehow we can stand outside it is a farce. It's an absolute farce. We are all shaped and infected by it. These five Black cops were, and the institution that they are a part of is deeply conscious of it. The real question is, are we going to admit it and do something about it? Or are we going to continue to pretend as if we are all individuals making individual choices and that these institutions are simply doing the best that they can, and maybe they have a few bad apples, but we can reform that out? This is not a reform problem. This is not something that, you know,
tweaks
around the edges can deal with. This is a deep-seated structural and cultural issue that we must address, because Black people continue to be shot down, murdered in the streets by police officers who are supposed to be there to protect us. And we cannot continue to live with Black people dying at the hands of the state and thinking that this is just the creation of a few bad apples.
I mean, if I hear one more time, it's, you know, the good cops who they hate the most are bad cops. And if we just got rid of the bad cops, we'd fix the problem. And you just pointed out that's just not the case. It's just, it's so much bigger than that. We have to look at the gestalt. So as I'm talking to you, Rashad, here's what I'm screaming about. We can't have this conversation in Florida. We can't have this conversation in a high school. We can't even have it on a university campus. You're talking about, are we going to admit it? And look what we have. We have an entire state being controlled by a fascist racist named Ron DeSantis, who is chilling everything. And part of the way he chills so effectively is that he writes laws that are so obtuse, so inaccurate, so non-specific that you check yourself. And yet looking at the event that just happened and this incredible conversation you and I are having, we're seeing happening on TV, we know are happening in homes and families around the country, and yet there is institutional barriers being put up to say you don't see it, you can't talk about it, you can't acknowledge it. I am so upset because I don't see a path to change. And I guess I'm looking at you saying, what do I do? What do we do other than Arnie having you on and saying, listen to this, ask yourself these questions. What can we begin to do, even in our own small space, to address not only what we saw happen, but the Ron DeSantis's who are telling you basically that even that is not true. You know, he's gonna describe your reality, even though that is a fairy tale and not a fact.
The late Hannah Arendt wrote a really powerful book about what happens when you create a non-thinking, uncritical population, and the slide that created and opened up for a totalitarian politic. And so this is, you know, deeply dangerous when we have state officials who are trying to undermine the ability to think and have open conversation and dialogue, and to call anything that they disagree with, you know, wokeness or indoctrination or whatever it is that they want to call it. This is dangerous. This is really dangerous. And it's not only dangerous because it opens up the potential for something more horrific in the long term. In the short term, it obscures our ability to confront realities like the murder of this Black man by a state institution. So here's one of the things that we can do. If we're really interested in transforming our institutions and our society, it requires thinking. It's not just action, right? Actions are shaped by the thoughts. And we need open, honest, and adventurous forms of thought to be able to transform the institutions that are part of our lives now so that they are not harmful, right? So one of the things that for me that I think is really important is particularly for white parents, straight white parents, I'm going to talk to you right now. You want to do something useful? Stop telling your child to treat everybody the same. Stop telling them that. That is not an analogy for dealing with race. Tell your child that you're all different and you have different lives and your lives are shaped differently because of your racial reality. This doesn't mean that they should not be kind and decent to people who are racially or gender or sexual or class different from them. But we can't continue to tell another generation of young people to just treat everybody the same because we're different. What we need to get young people and their parents to do is to confront that difference is a reality, and those differences fundamentally shape our experience and relationship to the world, and not to pretend like they do not exist. They exist. They're real. They shape all facets of our lives. And if we're really interested in any form of anti-racism, we have to first understand that racism is not about your individual feelings about a person or group of people. That's bias and prejudice. And yes, it can and has been harmful. But the real problem here is structural institutional racism that is baked into a number of our institutions that shape and inform our lives. And so we don't need any more individual action. What we need is collective action and recognition that race is real, difference matters, and that those things shape our lives and to not continue to tell another generation of people we are all the same, right? So, we are not, right? And what we don't need more individuals. We need collectives. We need collective groups of people to tackle the racial reality that we have in this country. And white people must be on the front lines. There's no more standing in the back. There's no more co-signing with whatever organization. We need white people on the front lines, the tip of the spear, because white people have to be involved in the solution because they have for too long either sat on the sidelines, co-signed, or been the problem.
I need to let you go, and you're coming back. I'm just telling you right now. So, Rashad, I gave a speech at Simmons about 20 years ago, and the speech at Simmons was a big women's conference. And I said, you know, a lot of people keep saying that what women are asking for is sameness. They want to be treated just the same as men. I said, no, we don't. That's not what equality is. Equality is not sameness. Let me give you proof of this. I'm going to do a math equation for you. 4 = 4. It's the same and it's equal. 2 + 2 = 4. Oh my goodness. It's equal, but not the same. 5 - 1 = 3 + 1. Oh my God. It's not the same, but it's equal. And I said to them, this is what we want. We are different. I don't want to be like them. I want my differences to be recognized. I want them to be valued. I want to see that I am part of this quilt and that without me, you are not as strong. But don't expect me to be like you. I am not the same as you. And I use that math equation. And one woman looked at me, she goes, oh my God, I never thought of it that way. That just makes so much sense. Because somehow the idea is I want to wear your trousers. I want to go to your Brooks Brothers. I don't want to be that. I want to be understood for me. And I think that's exactly what you're saying. And was I on the tip of the spear? No, but I was sort of screaming at people saying, what is it that people want to be seen? Mm-hmm. And it's not their sameness, but it is that they're striving for equality. And that is not as sameness. I am so grateful the conversation reached out to you. I now understand why. The title of the piece, everyone, it'll be at my Facebook page, Black Police Officers Aren't Colorblind. They're infected by the same anti-Black bias as American society and police in general. Rashad Chavez is an associate professor at the School of Social Transformation at Arizona State University. I am absolutely honored that you made the time to talk to me. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You better-